You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Break a Bat podcast, where baseball meets Broadway. An attempt to show that my two favorite mediums don't have to live in such separate worlds and maybe even break some stigmas. We're happy to have you with us. Now let's play ball. Hello and welcome to another edition of Break a Bat, where baseball meets Broadway. I'm your host, Al Malafronte, coming at you for the Broadway Podcast Network. Today's one of those shows that I always enjoy recording, as we get to welcome someone who's familiar to many for their work on screen, and they also have a tremendous body of work on stage. Her career in show business now spans more than four decades. Her Broadway credits include The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, as well as Getting and Spending. And on screen, you've probably seen her in anything from Happy Days to Matlock to my favorite show of all time, The Office. Most recently, she just finished shooting a new feature film called Paul's Promise, and we're so grateful she could join us today. So with that being said, I ask you all to please turn your attention to home plate. Just beyond the marquee, now batting, Linda Pearl. Linda, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It was fun to be here. I love your intersection of life in your show. It's very cool.
Well, thank you very much. That means a lot coming from someone who has certainly accomplished quite a bit on stage. I have to know, are you a bit of a baseball fan too, Linda?
You know, not myself, but it's in my DNA. My dad was a diehard Yankees fan, and He had, I'm going to show my ignorance here, but in 19, whatever it was, he went to the famous field in Chicago. What's the one?
Wrigley Field.
Wrigley Field. Thank you so much. Okay. And he stood in line with his college mate, overnight. And because the next day the Cubs were playing against the Yankees, must have been, right? And so he was standing in the He was seated in the bleachers. Sorry, this is kind of a long-winded story. In the bleachers that extended over the street, right? So the players must have been teeny weeny, and the game was going along. And as I say, he was there with his college buddy, and he saw Babe Ruth come out of the dugout and point to the outfield. And the Cubs were furious, you know, to say, I'm going to hit the effing ball, you know, over there. And the Cubs came charging out of the dugout, you know, whoa, how dare you? And then, of course, Babe Ruth hit it exactly where he said it would, home run, everything. And the field erupted, and my dad and his friend, along with everybody, you know, stood up, standing ovation. And my dad's friend's coat fell in the ruckus, fell between the bleachers down to the street below. And they see a homeless man pick the coat up, dust it off, put it on, and walk away. Of course, there was nothing they could do. There was no way they could get down there. But, and then it was so sweet because the Cubs players had again come out of their dugout just in admiration and cheers for what Babe Ruth had accomplished. So that's my tiny little link to baseball history, was that my dad was there. And years later, in his 90s, we took him there, and he, you know, told us that we went to a game there, and he, you know, oh God, honey, this is where it all happened. And so it was a fun full circle moment that we had with Dad.
That is absolutely amazing. We're about to celebrate the 90th anniversary of that home run. That was the 1932 World Series when Babe Ruth caught the shot.
Wow. Think of that. Yeah. Oh, well, I'll think of my dad on the day. That's fun. Yeah. That's about my son was a professional soccer player. So I'm a soccer mom is one of my most cherished, you know, things in life that I got to do. So a lot of time on pitches. Not that I understand the game. I still don't understand the game, unbelievably. Offsides, who knows? But such a beautiful sport, and many, many happy, happy hours with soccer, thanks to my son.
I love that. And to my understanding, these days you're hanging out in the Rocky Mountains. How's everything out there?
You know, today it's cold. Yes, I'm here unexpectedly. I have a home here, but you know, I've been living in New York, and who was one of the privileged few to have been doing a play when the pandemic hit. So we were at 59 East 59th. My understanding is that our billboard and our set is still up. How heartbreaking is that? Walking to the park on a beautiful March day, and I get a text saying, come to the theater. We're shuttering the building in 2 hours. So, I hung around in a stupor in New York, like all of us, for the next few days as the city just evaporated. Life in the city evaporated. And so I repaired to Colorado and, haven't been back to New York since, except on multiple Zoom calls with friends who are there. So it's not the world we expected to be living in, but here we are. And, please God, New York and all that's wonderful about it will return better than ever before too long.
I sure hope so. And I know that you were doing that play and, you've done a number of great concerts over the years, over at 54 Below and everything. You're really such a part mm-hmm. of the fabric of Broadway. But, mm-hmm. It's been nice. I see you've been able to keep quite busy throughout this whole pandemic, whether it be Paul's Promise. I know you put out a solo album last year. How helpful has that been for you to stay so active, despite everything we're going through?
Hugely. I feel so, so lucky. Yeah. We did a little, what do you call it? A web series, I guess. We did 11 or 12. Everybody just did one episode. There were a bunch of folks from Happy Days and a whole bunch of different, largely television writers and actors who we did this thing called Viral Vignettes. And it was all recorded on Zoom. And so we were able to do that. That was the first thing I did in April. So about a month after everything shut down. And that was like, okay, we're going to be okay. There'll be a way forward. And, over the last eight years, I've been doing on and off, Joan Didion's one woman play of The Year of Magical Thinking, which it's an extraordinary work and, a privilege always, always, always to do. So again, early days of the pandemic, I was able to film that in my living room. I duct taped my iPhone to a ladder in my living room and it was just me and the dogs and did the play. And anyway, we had put it up as a benefit for the Actors Fund. And, again, that just felt like, there you can do something. And then did a film down in New Mexico called Paul's Promise, a lovely independent film. And it was interesting, though, because that was last fall. So I want to say November, maybe October, we started. And the COVID protocol on sets was highly experimental at that stage. I mean, there were regulations in place, but they hadn't been practiced. And it's one thing, I'm sure, to sit around a table and sort of imagine what good protocol would be. But then we were among the first to be actually putting it into use. And so things like, how do you deal with craft service, or how do you deal with the line in lunch, or all kinds of things had not really been sorted. So we got shut down. We had some COVID cases. We got shut down. We were sent to our rooms for 10 days. Another round of tests, a whole bunch of people were infected, so we had to go home. But the producers were remarkable, and the unions were just so much help and so supportive. So we were able to reboot in LA and finish the film with clearer instructions on how to keep everybody safe. That was the thing. You wanted to keep everyone safe. And I did if please God, it'll get picked up. Gene Smart has a fantastic new show. Working title is Hacks. And so I get to play her sister. And, if that gets to do another season, then I'll be recurring on that. And then I did a movie for a Lifetime. We just got back from Vancouver a couple of days ago. And that was interesting because you're required to have 2 weeks of quarantine going into Canada, even though I've had my vaccinations and all of that, but still the protocol was very strict. And it was kind of a trip to go to your hotel room and hear the door, you know, close behind you. And there you are for 2 weeks. So food was delivered, but only food. And the occasional bottle of wine, which was greatly appreciated. I did have a balcony. And so I became friendly, how pathetic. I became friendly with a seagull I named Elmer. And I'd put little bits of food on the balcony. And Elmer and I became friends. And every morning, 6 or 6:30, whether I wanted to wake up or not, Elmer was out there squawking, "Where's breakfast? Come on." And eventually, you know, he'd sit there and listen to music and we'd talk. He would squawk a couple of times. I would squawk three times. He would squawk three times. It's like, Elmer had a lot going on. And then around tea time, he'd come back again. Come on, time for a second snack. So this was my amusement in quarantine. I mean, you know, all of our lives, I think, there are these little bizarre little episodes because of COVID that we've all experienced a ramping up in some areas of life and a paring down in many areas and a kind of a reboot on your priorities and essentials. And thank heavens for Zoom. I'm in a couple of Zoom chats with friends, different populations here and there. And oh, it's been so helpful just to keep, you know, proactively those ties that bind in all of our lives. So, be glad when it's over.
You and me both. And now let me ask you, what's like, what do you have any new passions or any new things that you've mastered throughout the pandemic or things you've gotten to do that, you know, you had put off for a while, maybe, you know, something that, you know, whether it be a passion project professionally or whether it's, you know, new hobbies, anything on that front?
I've mastered absolutely nothing. I've improved my Spanish. So that's been fun. I've been painting a lot and perfectly dreadful paintings, but it's been cathartic to do. And so some fair amount of landscapes after New Mexico, which is just a breathtaking area. I think the biggest thing is that I, a year and a half or so ago, I bumped into a long-term acquaintance, Patrick Duffy. It was like, "Hey, old buddy, nice to see ya." And that led to a very rare email or, you know, happy Christmas kind of thing. And then somehow at the beginning of the pandemic, we talked, and then it's not like either of us had anything on our schedules for the next year. So we ended up Zooming, and then we Zoomed every night. We Zoomed every night for 2 to 3 hours. And after 2.5 months of that, bless his heart, somewhere in the middle of there, it was, wait a minute, this isn't just chummy anymore. This is something else. So he got in his car from Oregon and he drove to Colorado from Oregon. And we were both, you know, terrified because what if it's a terrible idea? We thought, this could be a disaster. But we thought, well, let's give it a go. And we've established this lovely friendship now. So if nothing comes of it, we're grown-ups enough to remain friends. Well, that's it. We've been together ever since. So we're 10 months old now. I mean, how silly is that?
What a success story, though. Two folks from the golden ages of television. I love that.
That's fun. And it's probably premature to say so, but we're going to go off to England in the fall and do a tour of 12 Angry Men. It's like, so we're going to be on the boards together, which will be so much fun.
Congratulations.
It's 10 Angry Men and 2 really pissed off women because our producer, the wonderful Bill Kenwright, had this, you know, vision to update it to a degree. I mean, none of the dialogue or anything like that's changing, but two of the characters will now be women. So I will be one of the really pissed off women, and Patrick will be one of the 10 angry men.
That is fantastic. I hope they broadcast that somewhere, because I personally would really love to see that. Especially, you know, I mentioned before what a, you know, rich career that you've had, and you know, I've always been curious about this for someone like you. You're such an accomplished stage actress, but you've gotten to work on some of the most iconic television shows of all time. What do you enjoy doing more, stage or screen?
Oh, stage for sure. I mean, I love them both, and it's hard to compare because they're so. Related, of course, but very different. But the theater is the actor's medium. It's where I started. It's what I keep returning to. It's what television has afforded me to do because you know, the regionals pay what they pay. But it's been my, I never finished college, but work in the theater has been my education, lifetime education. And I feel so fortunate to have worked with the people that I have and to have been directed by the directors. And, you know, it's an extraordinary journey and a learning curve that never, never, never ends. I remember a long time ago, Robert Lewis, one of the founders of the Group Theater, and he taught at Yale Drama School for years. And he had come out to Los Angeles to teach the last many years of his life. And I, went to have the way that you got into his class was you had an interview. So I was excited to have my interview, and I'm waiting for my turn. And the pupil before me, the interviewee before me, comes out of the room, and it's Anne Bancroft. And I go in and to meet Mr. Lewis, and Bobby was just, he was gobsmacked. He was so happy to have had this conversation with her. Of course, I was thrilled to have met her ever so briefly on her way out. But the thing he said to her was, "Why are you coming to class?" And Bobby said that she looked at him like he was, you know, insane to have asked the question. And she said, "Well, but I have so much to learn. I feel like I'm just starting." And she was, oh gosh, probably in her 60s at the time, you know, and then she was a classmate of mine, which was really fun. So, but anyway, that's the point. You never stop learning. It never fails to humble you because there's so many failures along the way, but it's a joyful journey. And, you know, it relates to sports in the sense that the team spiritness of it. I mean, it really is a coming together and on a level playing field. You are, I had the chance to work with people. We have different backgrounds and different age groups, and you are absolutely toe-to-toe peers. And it's a real lesson in democracy and in its culture relates handily to sports.
I couldn't agree with you more. And that's why I thought it was particularly interesting that you mentioned that you were doing a one-woman show before. I mean, that must be, what's that experience like for you? You know, having done this as long as you have, is something like that, you know, that's especially shooting it during a pandemic, like you said, are you comfortable doing shows like that? Or do you prefer, you know, the team dynamic?
It was just absolutely terrifying. I remember the first day I sat down to tuck into the script. I had my highlighter, as one does, and I started to highlight. I thought, you fool, it's just you. Everything on the page is you. But I never felt alone up there when I got to do it because of Joan. You know, Joan, well, she's an extraordinary writer, and this felt like something else. You know, she peered so fearlessly and articulated so brilliantly every moment of her descent into the hell of grief and to her journey back out into life that you, I mean, her wisdom and her poetry, was a great life lesson to be able to say and to pass along. At some point I was doing it I don't know, I want to say in Kansas, I'm not sure where I was, and was in the supermarket a couple of days later, and a gal came up to me and she said, "Oh, I saw the play and I lost my husband 3 weeks ago, and now I know I'm not crazy." I mean, that's why we do it, right? That was a wonderful sort of proof of the pudding moment, you know, and a kudos to Joan that she had, you know. Well, I felt so lucky to be a conduit for Joan's wisdom to this woman in her in a real hour of need, and the theater can do that. But yeah, it was daunting. And the other thing is that it's an hour and 35 minutes when I do it. My son's idea of a nightmare mother talking nonstop. But I mean, I can't remember what I had for dinner last night. And the fact that your brain can wrap itself around these words is another testament to Miss Didion, because it's so well written and the ideas falling one after another support each other, you know, as the journey continues. So anyway, it was a privilege and an education.
Now, you mentioned someone coming up to you in a supermarket and recognizing you. Does that happen a lot, you know, as far as you work on Happy Days too?
Well, it does, but also it doesn't. I mean, one time I was on a plane, but television, you know, you've been in people's living room, in my case, for a long time. I never had, like Patrick, this, you know, extraordinary thing happened called Dallas. And so he is very, very recognizable. I'm more like people, I mean, sure, sometimes they know, oh, you know, Matlock, Happy Days, whatever. But a lot of the times too, it's like, gosh, didn't we go to high school together? Or, you know, the people think they know you when they don't, or yet, or, you know, we haven't had a chance to meet yet. I was getting off a plane, standing in the aisle as one does. And there was a guy in front of me and some people behind me, and we're just waiting our turn to exit the plane. And this guy turned around to me with a wink and a nod. And he said, "Seattle, babe." Like, what? No. And he was sort of puzzled, and we inched forward and he turned. He said, "Oh, no, Chicago, baby." And, you know, the intimation was that we'd had, you know, a one night stand in one of these cities. And finally, mercifully, the woman behind me said, "She's an actress, asshole," or whatever. Sorry, I don't know if I could say that. But I mean, I was flummoxed. I didn't know, you know, how to help this guy out of the hole he continued to dig for himself. So, yeah, sometimes you get recognized, and then sometimes you have the guy, you know, like that in front of you.
Do you realize at the time that it's such an iconic show that you're a part of? You're, you know, an iconic team, you know, to use a little sports parallel, like you mentioned earlier?
No, I think, you know, as an actress, I'm just so grateful to have the gig. Now, when I went, because I joined the office so far into its magnificent success, I was aware of that. But, you know, once you cross that threshold of being on the set, then you're just in it and trying to do the best work you can. And what a great group. You know, that was interesting, because I guess I came in when they were, I'm not sure, this might not be right, but I'm going to say 4 years old. So at that point, they had won so many awards, and they'd been on the cover of every possible magazine and, you know, all of that. They really could have just shown up and phoned it in, but it wasn't so. Everybody turned up to that set like it was their first day of work. And I have to think that starts, you know, largely with Steve Carell. He's just a prince of a human being, and was enthusiastic and excited about the work and really worked hard, you know. And it was they had the weave between all of them, the writers and the actors, was so strong and well-tended, a well-tended garden. So that was just fun to go in and witness that. It felt very much like the atmosphere that was on the set at Happy Days, always. really strong family, really strong ties, and enduring lifelong friendships have come out of that.
Now, who have you stayed close with in the Office cast?
With Kate and, but Happy Days more, like, you know, Donnie Most and Anson. I mean, because we were all babies when we started it. Those, you know, we've been witness to so many stages in each other's life. But Kate Flannery, who's such a brilliant comedian, and yeah.
Take me through shooting the birthday lunch.
Painful. Painful because, you know, I mean, as a woman, clearly a vanity, it was... It was like, oh my gosh, it was just, it was hard. And, but fun. I mean, Jenna and John and Steve, you know, they're such mega talents. And so, you know, just to be at the table in this case, literally, was fun. And the Office was interesting because they, oh, I had assumed before going to work there that a lot of it was improv, and it is, but mostly it isn't. So that we always shot exactly what was scripted, and sometimes, if there was time, then the director would say, "Oh, just, you know, just go for it," and so then we would carry on and do a little bit of improv, which was fun. I think maybe a little bit of the improv got used in that in the final product. I am not sure, but again, a testament to the actors that they made it look so as if so much of it was improvised. But no, the writers had a very, very firm grip on the work that was done. John fascinates me. This was before his, you know, the next chapter of his huge career. Where he's done all the wonderful feature film work. And he's like Harrison Ford and Henry Fonda. If those two great talents had had a baby, it would have been John. I'm just awed by him. And it was exciting to know someone that young in their career, because then you know it's all ahead of them and him. And it's really fun to witness from a great distance his continuing successes. That's his continuing success, I should say. Forgive me.
It really was such a likable cast, you know, on all fronts. And of course, you know, your character really did have some great moments. I know you appeared in close to a dozen episodes, and you know, that little stretch there, especially in season 6, meant quite a bit to me too. It was just so much fun to watch the whole dynamic of Michael dating Pam's mom, and that was honestly amazing.
Oh man.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
On a lighter note, Linda, we do a little segment here on the show called Fastball Derby. And, you know, using our sports backdrop here, I want you to picture yourself in the batter's box, okay?
Okay.
And I'm Aroldis Chapman. the Yankees flamethrowing all-star closer. He throws 105 miles an hour, major league record. Just have to throw that out there. And you got to think quick here because, you know, he's throwing so fast. I'm going to ask you a question. You tell me the first thing that comes to mind. How does that sound?
I'm terrified. I'm absolutely terrified. But go for it.
All right. Favorite New York City meal?
Carnegie Deli cheesecake. Carnegie Deli, what happened? Yeah. Or Jamie's at the Russian Tea Room. I don't know. It's a toss up.
You had me at Carnegie. Now you're you've got me missing Roxy. You've got me missing Stage Deli. All the old spots are going away. Now Katz's is the last one standing. So I could always I always love the desserts there. And also, you know, after a nice pastrami sandwich, of course.
Yeah. Oh, I can feel the heartburn.
Team Derek Jeter or Team Alex Rodriguez?
Oh, Jeter. Yeah. I'm not sure why, but yeah, Jeter. Yeah.
All-time favorite film?
Favorite film? Okay, I don't know favorite, but one that totally changed my mind about the death penalty was Dead Man Walking. I was in favor of the death penalty, and I saw that film and came out adamantly against it. So, yeah, I'm going to go with that.
I haven't seen that one. I'll have to check that out.
Sean Penn and, oh gosh, beautiful actress. Yikes. Anyway, yeah, Dead Man Walking.
Fact about Linda Pearl that would surprise people the most.
Oh, gee whiz. Okay, well, this is kind of a downer. This is a real downer. I had 6 miscarriages. and I say that because, it happened, but women, I find, don't talk about the fact that they had miscarriages. It's very, very common. And I kept going and have my beautiful son. So it was an ordeal. It was an effort. But I was very lucky that persistence won the day. And that, so I just say that to the young women out there, don't give up hope and keep going because you'll have your baby.
Most embarrassing on set or on stage moment?
Oh, geez. Okay. Quick change. This happened twice, but, which one is the better? Romeo and Juliet. And we, you know, it's the lark scene and I go behind the curtain to put on, my dress. I'm Starkers and I leave the bed shrouded in a sheet and go behind the curtain to step into my dress. So that happened, you know, you drop the sheet, you step into your dress and you pull the dress up. Well, as I've dropped the sheet and I'm bent over derriere, sadly, to the audience, I hear this whoosh. And what it was the curtain falling down. The curtain fell down. So now I am buck-ass naked. And I hear a gasp from the audience that almost sucked me off the stage into the front row. They felt so badly for me because clearly it was an accident. It was not meant to happen. And we lost the play from that moment because they felt so badly for me. It paled in comparison to the fact that her love of her life was dead and now she kills herself. So, it was, that was like, what do? You just got to keep going moment. And I wouldn't wish it on anyone.
180 now, proudest moment of your career.
Of my career? Oh, well, I don't know, proudest, happiest moment. You know, sometimes life happens in a postcard. So when I was doing Tom Sawyer on Broadway at the Minskoff and we're doing the big dance number and Paul Gimignani is conducting in the pit magnificent Paul Gimignani. And I'm dancing with John Dossett, who's just one of the most gorgeous human beings ever. And this is a matinee, and seated on a little stool next to Paul was my son, who was 4 or 5 at the time. And I, somewhere coming out of a pirouette, I'd see my son sort of bored out of his mind sitting on the stool. But it was one of those split seconds in life where so many of the good things in your life come together. People I loved on a project I love in this magnificent theater. And there was a glimpse of my son. And I just was so happy and grateful. And it was just one of those moments.
Lastly, best piece of advice anyone ever gave you?
I'm really lucky that I've had a lot of terrific advice from people young and old. But there was a moment, I'm sorry, this will be awfully name droppy, but there was a moment, it was sort of one of those, you know, passages in life that was just awful. And, but I thought it was a Christmas party at Rosemary Clooney's house, and Rosemary was a friend. And, I thought, you know, I'd put on my red Christmassy dress and, you know, managed to get some mascara on and went to the party, and I thought I was putting on a really good front, you know, and I found my bootstraps that day and it's going to go forward. And I passed Rosemary. She liked to sit in a chair in her living room underneath a beautiful portrait of Jose Ferrer. And she grabbed me by the hand as I was walking past, and she looked through me as only she could do. And in that moment, I just felt like I was standing there with no clothes on. She saw everything raw inside. And she said, "Keep singing, baby. The music will never let you down." And I knew in the moment that it meant a lot, you know, but it's one of those phrases that has come back to me so many times. And it's not just keep singing, you know, it's keep going, take the next step, take the next breath, change the energy, change the character, find your resilience, and life will realign and the forces will move you forward again. And so anyway, so that was, yeah, a very powerful piece of advice that I've come back to many times.
Well, it served you really well, Linda. And this was such an honor. Thank you so much for joining me today. This was a great time.
Thanks for having me. Thank you. Stay safe.
You as well. And to all the folks at home, thank you so much for listening. This is Al Malafronte signing off for Break a Bat and the Broadway Podcast Network. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to Break a Bat. This is produced by the fine folks at the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit and subscribe at bpn.fm/breakabat. You can find me online at break_a_bat_podcast. And you can also find the Broadway Podcast Network on Instagram at Broadway Podcast Network. It's been so great having you here with us today, and we'll see you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.